have him with us this morning. He is one of the folks who has come here to Champaign-Urbana to take part in Cyberfest. He introduced last night a special showing of the film 2001 and will be the host for another event tonight and was good enough to come and spend some time talking with us. He is the only film critic to win the Pulitzer Prize for criticism. He now has, for 20 years, been doing a program with his partner, Gene Siskel, reviewing films. He has written a number of books, including his latest, which is Ebert's Little Movie Glossary.
Nope, I have a later one.
Oh, you have a later one? Oh, I got this off your website. You'll have to get this updated. What is that?
The new one is Roger Ebert's Book of Film. It's a big, big, fat Norton anthology of readings from the last 100 years of cinema.
I'll have to call my close friends at Norton and have them send me a copy.
Yes, right. Well, you could always buy one as a last resort.
Oh, weasel like me? No, never. It's the only perk I get in this job. Anyway, he's written a number of books, including books that have reviews, like Roger Ebert's Video Companion. There are also collections of some of his writing about people who make movies, like Kiss is Still a Kiss, which has got some really good essays in there. And since 1967, he's been a film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. Real pleased that you are here.
Nice to be back in Urbana.
I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about Stanley Kubrick and about his movies. It's what an amazing range of work to do so many different kinds of movies. When you think about 2001, A Clockwork Orange, Spartacus, Barry Lyndon, so many
Tunes
different
of Glory,
movies.
Dr. Strangelove, Full Metal Jacket, Lolita.
Is there something that sort of holds those movies all together, even though they're very different?
I don't know if there is. I've read a couple of books about Kubrick that try to force a theme or a consistency into his work. But few directors have made films so different. And it's not like Howard Hawks, for example, who worked in every genre, so he made westerns, war movies, car racing movies. It's more that Kubrick begins with ideas that are in different places and then follows those ideas to their ultimate destination. In 2001, which I saw again last night in that beautiful 70-millimeter print at the Virginia Theater, he has dialogue that is totally pointless. Entire dialogue scenes where nobody says anything that is of the slightest use or interest, frankly banal. Dialogue. In other movies, the dialogue sparkles with interest. Obviously, in 2001, at one point Kubrick said he didn't want, in 2001, any of the dialogue to be important to understanding the movie. And the dialogue is just, it's like he's shooting a scene to show people talking. What is this scene about? It's about people talking. What are they saying? That doesn't matter. So there is a totally different stylistic idea than he uses anywhere else in any of his other films. And it's interesting. He doesn't have, in my opinion, a consistent approach to selecting material, and that's fine. Every movie is a completely new departure.
This movie, I know, has inspired a great many probably late-night conversations about what it's about. And obviously he did not want to make something that was obvious. Do you think that he had some idea what he thought it was about? And has he really talked about what I, Stanley Kubrick, think this movie is about?
Well, there was a 15-year-old girl who wrote a paper in 1968 about the movie. And he wrote her and said, "Your paper is the most intelligent writing I've read about the film." And so if you read her paper, maybe you can guess what he thought. He has not explained the film. This is at the time it was made, it cost $10.5 million. That would be a $100 million film if it were made today. A $100 million experimental underground personal film, nonlinear. It's just amazing that people love it so much, because today Hollywood seems to believe that all people want is an action picture with lots of special effects and things blowing up and an amazing sequence every 4 minutes. And here is a film with no dialogue for the first 30 minutes and really no dialogue for the last 30 minutes and no dialogue in between of great consequence except for some conversations with a computer. A movie that doesn't explain itself. It's about people who a manned space mission to seek out another black monolith like one that has been found on the moon, but the movie never tells you who put the monoliths in place, what they represent, or even what they are. At the end, the hero has an amazing experience, but you're never told what it is. And then he grows old and dies in a hotel room somewhere beyond Jupiter and turns into a star child who turns and looks at the audience. It's like music. The movie is like music. When you hear two pieces of great music, certainly one makes you feel one way, another makes you feel another way. But you can't paraphrase them and give them a narrative. You can't say Beethoven's fourth is about this and Beethoven's ninth is about that. You can just say one makes me feel one way and one makes me feel another way. And 2001 makes you feel a certain way. I know there are people who have interpretations of every single shot in the movie, but of course they never agree on what those shots mean.
Hmm. Earlier in the week, we talked with Harry Lang, who was one of the artists, I guess, was involved with the production mm-hmm. of the film, who had been before, had worked for NASA, mm-hmm. and then went and worked for Kubrick, and after that worked on a lot of other movies. And he was talking about the fact that there was some discussion at some point about having the aliens actually appear.
Yes. They had tests to create aliens, and all the aliens they created looked ridiculous to them, so they decided to leave them out.
That's a great – it turned out to be a great idea to have the device essentially of the monolith as a stand-in for the aliens,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Your proverbial blank slate that you can –
There may be one brief glimpse of proto-aliens in the movie during the sound and light trip when the astronaut is hurtling through the space gate or whatever it is. There's one shot where there are five pyramids on the horizon, and then some more creep in from the sides until there are nine altogether. At one point in there, the original short story by Arthur Clarke was of a pyramid that was found on the moon and not a monolith. Mm-hmm. And at one point, they talked about making a kind of a pyramidal sort of alien. And maybe those shapes suggest some of their thinking along that way, but they're certainly never identified or presented as if they are aliens.
We have some callers here. I want to ask you one mm-hmm. more question, and I promise we'll,
sure.
we'll let these people talk with you. Now, after 10 years, Stanley Kubrick is making a movie? No.
He's actually, after this long period since Full Metal Jacket, he's making a movie, and he had started to make a movie called AI, Artificial Intelligence, and he was preparing that. And then he felt, after seeing Jurassic Park, that he needed to give more thought to the special effects, that new things had happened with computers and special effects that he wanted to digest. And so he switched over to the movie he's making now with Tom Cruise. But AI is still going forward with another team in terms of its preparation, pre-production, and special effects. So that, oddly enough, we may get two Kubrick movies in the next 2 or 3 years after not having had any for 10 years.
Why did it take such a long time?
I don't know. Stanley doesn't confide. He lives on his estate in England. He's not a hermit. He associates with people. He talks to Joe Hyams at Warner Brothers 3 or 4 times a week. He works with the same people, and he talks to them all the time. You know, he talks. I mean, he goes out to eat, and he's not living in a room, but he does no press. He never talks about his work. He does no interviews, and he doesn't travel. He won't fly. So as a result, there's this whole industry in trying to figure out what he's going to do next because he simply isn't interested in gossip or interviews or chat.
Our guest this morning is film critic Roger Ebert, and we have several people who would like to talk with you, so we'll give them the chance mm-hmm. to do that. The number, if you would, after we talk with some folks, if you would like to call in, the number is 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And we have some folks here. We'll start off with someone on the campus, line one. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. I wanted to thank Mr. Ebert for the splendid job he did hosting the movie last night.
Were you there?
I was there.
Wasn't that, you know, when the curtain opened on the size of that screen, The audience applauded. They were not applauding the movie, and they were not applauding the credits. They were applauding the screen.
I thought they were applauding the MGM logo.
Right.
Which is so big.
I know.
Well, 2001 is one of my three favorite movies of all time, the other two being The Third Man and Citizen Kane.
You have excellent taste.
But last night was only the fifth time that I've seen 2001. I've seen the other two, well, maybe a dozen, 15 times, because I'll only see 2001 in a movie theater.
Oh, yeah, it's not the same on television.
And it had been 20-something years, well, 68, since I had seen it in 70mm, mm-hmm. and it was magnificent. But I wanted to ask you something about a comment that you made afterwards in the discussion about the way movies are released and how they are made or broken in the first weekend, that by the Friday night of the first release, they know whether or not it will be a hit. Did Fargo follow that formula? Did they know it was going to be a hit the first
Fargo did not open in 2,000 theaters. What they will do, the key distributors of, let's say, independent films, such as Miramax, Gramercy, Sony Classics, Fine Line, and so forth, is they will open in a limited number of theaters and try to go out a little more slowly, which is the way all movies used to be handled. They don't want to risk 2,000 prints on one weekend, and because, you know, Fargo wouldn't have placed in the top five. They kind of knew that. And then it would have been saddled with the image of being a loser picture, so it's better to open slowly and add theaters and accumulate money. You take Lone Star by John Sayles, which was never in the top 10 at the box office, but at the end of the year was still playing in most of the theaters it opened in. It ran for 6 months in Chicago, week after week, you know, developing an audience through word of mouth.
Well, then, do you think that there's hope that the studios will allow movies to build that slow following the way they used to?
I hope so.
Because of the Academy Award nominations that both Lone Star and Fargo have garnered?
Well, I hope so. I noticed that Sling Blade opened today at the Art Theater in Champaign, and I imagine that's its first run.
It is.
Here. And so maybe it was wise to wait until it got some nominations, because now people are likely to be very interested in going to see it. Can you tell me what the experience of Fargo was in Champaign-Urbana? How did it open, and how long did it run, or do you know?
I think it ran a couple of weeks, maybe as long as a month. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. And I think I saw it at a multiplex. I saw Lone Star at the Art, but we saw Fargo at a multiplex. But uh-huh. it was truly a word-of-mouth film. People came out and told their friends about it, said, have you seen this? You ought to go see this lady playing the pregnant police chief. She's just remarkable.
Oh, she is, and I think she might win the Oscar. You know, it's so discouraging to me as a movie critic, because I like movies, and I hope that people, when they go, have a good time. And you just want to just almost take people and shake them and say, look, I know you've heard all about Independence Day. I know it, you know, grossed $35 million over the weekend. I know they've spent $20 million on TV ads, and you've been hearing about it for 6 months. But frankly, just between you and me, if you want to have a good time at the movies, don't go see Independence Day. Go see Fargo. I just hope people don't get caught up in the syndrome that they have to go to the hit movie. They want to be associated with a winner. They want to go to the movie that places first for the weekend. Frequently, that will not be the best movie in town.
Well, I'm going to let other people talk.
Okay.
I want to thank you for what you do to keep people remembering your hometown, for keeping the U of I in the public.
Cybertown, USA.
Thanks again.
Thanks for the call. We'll go on here. Next caller is in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had a couple questions about silent film, and then a question from my grandmother. The first question is about, have you seen a performance of Visions of Light with Gerard's Joan of Arc accompanied by Einhorn's Oratorio?
I have not. I was out of town when it was at the Medina Temple 2 weeks ago. I know that they then came down here to the Krannert Center with it. However, I've been in contact on email with Einhorn himself, who sent me a CD of his music. And I did a review of the movie itself, The Passion of Joan of Arc. I have a new series in the Sun-Times called The Great Movies that runs every other Sunday. And I go back into the past and review a great movie from the past that I have never reviewed before. This is kind of like looking for extra work. And you can get it on the web, by the way. It's www.suntimes.com, The Great Movies. And I did re-review Passion of Joan of Arc, and I've listened to the music, but I have not seen the movie with the music because I wasn't in town. I hear it was a great evening.
Oh, it was wonderful. It's one of the best film experiences I've ever had when it was here at Krennert.
Is it Visions of Light? I think it's Voices of Light is the name of the oratorio.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, with the Anonymous Four.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the soloists. The other question I had about silent film was on January 20th, Lawrence Austin was shot outside of his theater in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I know, the silent film theater.
Yeah, I wondered if you knew him and could comment on his work or anything.
Well, I didn't know him. I did meet him, and I have been to the silent film theater once. This was a theater over on, I think it was on Fairfax? Well, anyway, it doesn't matter, where he showed silent films. And he was just apparently shot down in some kind of random street shooting or violence or mugging or something.
Well, apparently he was a treasure trove of information regarding science.
So right. Yeah, it's a tragedy.
I wonder if you knew any other people that had as much knowledge at their fingertips as he apparently did.
Well, we just lost William Everson a year ago, who was a great historian of film in general, and including silent film. We still have Kevin Brownlow, who wrote The Parade's Gone By, and who is still very much with us in England. And then there's a new generation. A lot of the people who were silent film fans grew up with silent films, and they're getting pretty old now. But young people are rediscovering silent films. And the problem, of course, is oftentimes one of preservation, because these old nitrate prints occasionally just crumble into dust, and so they have to be transferred and cared for. And the American Film Institute is trying to do that. And one thing that you might be interested in, do you ever go on the web?
Yeah.
Do you know that the American Film Institute has a web page now where they show silent films?
Oh, no, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. This week they're showing The Boat, a short subject by Buster Keaton. Remember the guy who builds the boat in his basement, and the boat is too big to get out of the door, and he... And it's shown in a little QuickTime movie, which is kind of flickery. But silent films, you know, the problem with QuickTime on the web is that so far it can't show 24 frames a second, which is the way most movies are. It can only show about 8 or 10 frames a second. But silent films were 16 frames a second, so they look better on QuickTime than talking films do anyway. They at least look better than the talking films. And you can go to the AFI site on the web and see a different silent film every week.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you can also rent them on video, and that's probably preferable between you and me.
The question from my grandmother was, she worked at Fear's Grocery Store on Main Street during World War II and knew a woman named Wanda Ebert.
Oh, yeah, that's my aunt.
That's your aunt.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, because she had wondered if that might be a relation.
Yes, that was my father's sister. Mm. Sears Grocery on Main.
Pop Sears on
Pop Sears.
Yeah.
Oh, but that was over on, like, Main in the residential neighborhood.
Right.
Yeah, not Main downtown Urbana, but over toward...
Lincoln School. And,
yes. Yeah. Oh, I've been to Pop Sears. I probably met your grandmother.
Oh, you may have.
My grandmother, who lived on Clark Street, would send me over there to, you know, Roger, now I want you to go over there and take this money and keep it in your pocket and don't lose it and bring me back half a pound of coffee, a loaf of bread, and you can get a Tootsie Roll for yourself.
Yeah. Well, my grandmother's listening, so I'm sure she's enjoying your...
Oh, yeah, Wanda Ebert was my aunt. She died about 10 years ago.
Mm. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, thanks
for
the call.
Pop Sears. Sure, I remember Pop Sears.
A little bit before my time.
Another famous local grocer that I remember is Harry Rusk. And he had the little neighborhood store in over by where I lived on Washington Street in Urbana, and then later he opened up a store for many years on Green Street right in Campustown.
You lived on Washington Street in Urbana?
Yeah, corner of Washington and Maple from 1942 until 1962. Then I moved to Illinois Street, and then I moved over on campus, and finally I left for Chicago in 66. Mm-hmm. 410 East Washington.
Oh, I live at about 310 years, West Washington.
Oh, great. About 4 years ago, my wife and I knocked on the door, and a wonderful woman named Violet, who lives there, let us in, and we looked around the old house. I went down to the basement, and I really felt a chill because there were lights in the basement ceiling, and they had strings on them that you could pull. Yeah. And my father had taken building blocks, spelling out E-B-E-R-T, and tied them to the ends of the strings, and they were still there. Still there. I was amazed. She let me have the E to take home with me.
That's amazing.
That is amazing. Let's go on here. We'll talk with somebody else. Sam Muhammad, line three.
Hello. Hello. Two questions. First of all, when the movie is reissued for its 30-year anniversary, will it also be in 70 millimeter?
Only if you're lucky enough to see it in a 70-millimeter house. The movie is controlled right now by Turner Pictures, which took over the MGM library. And they restored this 70-millimeter print we saw last night was from Turner in Atlanta. And that's kind of part of their ramping up for the 30th anniversary. They're going to do a lot with the movie in 68 and in 98. But, of course, most theaters don't have 70-millimeter projectors. What I'm hopeful is that a theater like the Virginia could, in addition to its stage stuff, do revivals of these great movies. I know that they have a $500,000 loan from the city of Champaign, and they're trying to raise another $1 million, pay off the loan and raise $1 million more to refurbish the theater, get it up to code, get it up to standard. It's in good shape. I mean, everybody who was there last night saw a great movie. Nobody had any complaints. But the projection booth has to be rebuilt and things like that have to be done.
I heard a couple people last night wonder if possibly you would donate some.
Oh, sure. I'll give them the whole $1.5 million. You bet.
I'll
come and do a benefit. I did a benefit for the art. I'd be happy to do a benefit for the Virginia. But what would be neat is the current pattern in restoration is they take an old film, they restore it, they make it in perfect shape, and they make a print. And they open the print theatrically in order to get reviews and interest. And then they release it in a new anniversary video edition on tape and disc. And but the theatrical release is important as part of the promotion. And in recent years, we've seen revived and restored versions of Dr. Strangelove, My Fair Lady, the Star Wars pictures, Lawrence of Arabia, The Sound of Music, Vertigo, wow. And coming up a week from Friday in Chicago is The Godfather. Well, here's what I would do if I were the Virginia Theater. Maybe they can't pay the rate for the first run on one of these films. And, in fact, their lease prohibits them from showing first-run films. But let's say Star Wars plays out theatrically, which it's doing right now, and then in 3 months it comes out on video. The moment the movie goes to video, the Virginia can legally show it. At that point, they could get it cheaper, too, because it wouldn't be first run. So they could say, now see Star Wars on the screen that it was made for. And if you here in Champaign-Urbana knew that at the Virginia Theater you could see a movie in 70 millimeter,
I would wait.
Or you could see a movie on that big screen, you would go to it.
Definitely.
I mean, they talk about the problems of exhibition and the problems of booking independent theaters. But the fact is, if you're selling something that nobody else in town is selling, people will go. I mean, everybody who was there last night, I am sure, is thinking in the back of their mind, the next time the Virginia shows a 70-millimeter film, I'm going to go there.
Would it be that expensive for a place like the Virginia to get old movies like Gone with the Wind and Wizard of Oz and show them?
No, it wouldn't be that expensive, but it might not be that profitable. You know, the notion that there's a big market for repertory cinema is probably flawed, unfortunately, because people are accustomed now to renting videos and looking at home. Yeah, they won't go to the movies just to see an old film like The Wizard of Oz, unfortunately. That was recently restored, too, by the way. What they will do is they will go to the movies to see a movie in a way that they can't see it at home. Like this, the first caller that we had, who said 2001 was one of his three favorite films, but he's only seen it five times because he will not see it except in a theater.
Likewise.
Yeah, because 2001 just doesn't make it on television. It's not the same movie. You've got to see it on a big screen. And I think that would be the way the Virginia would go, not just showing repertory in general, but showing revivals of particular restored classic big screen films. And then in addition, they plan to have concerts and stage and theatrical productions.
My second question, I asked it last night, but I don't think the man who answered it understood what I was asking. At the beginning of 2001, the various cloud shots when all the apes were there and all the vistas he would show of the savannas and things were obviously still photographs,
yeah,
not moving pictures. Any idea of why he did that? It was distracting to see apes running around and the clouds never move.
I think, well, first of all, I think that the one answer that you got last night might have had some truth to it. He didn't want to send a motion picture crew to Africa.
Well, that makes sense. But
and it's so much cheaper to send a photographer down there with an 8x10 camera. Apart from that, I think that in the, you know, most of the opening shots don't have any apes in them.
But you could tell the grass wasn't moving, the clouds weren't moving.
That was because they were actually shooting on a soundstage. Now, they could have had back projection of moving pictures instead of back projection of a still photograph.
Right.
But in the opening shots, I think he wanted to show, like the dawn of time, I think he wanted it to be still.
I was wondering if a moment frozen in time was his attitude.
I think in a sense, things didn't start. It's almost like the Earth was waiting, waiting for intelligence to appear.
Okay. I'm just wondering.
Or it might have just been because he didn't have moving pictures, you know. Sometimes the most pragmatic answer is the best one.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Our guest here this morning is film critic Roger Ebert.
Maybe Roger Karras decided to get involved with the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals after seeing that ape beating the other ape to death in 2001.
Could be.
Of course, animals are cruel to other animals. I guess that's the difference.
Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Caller in Taylorville next, line number four.
Taylorville, I have a lot of relatives there.
Yeah, well, I might as well be one of yours, but I ain't.
Okay.
Unless there's some miscegenation going on that I don't know about.
Oh, okay. We'll look in the family Bible and see if we find your name.
I was hoping, Roger, sometime, before I cash in my own chips, you and your pal might do a periodical, let's say, six times a year program, as opposed to your one for the larger audience on art film, silent, foreign, etc. And I wanted to hasten on and say, we were talking the last time you were in Champaign-Urbana, I called, and I was talking about the sort of flicks I like, which one of your previous callers alluded to. I think, for example, there are at least three chaplains that are better than 2001. It's a great movie, I'll grant you that, but to borrow... I forget which particular film noir it was, but somebody, I think it was a private dick talking about a woman, a little bit cold around the heart.
I 2001 is a very cold movie, that's for sure.
I see those people as maybe the effects of technology. They seem almost... ghostly, disembodied.
Yeah, I think that may be kind of the point, that man has used his tools and now his tools are using him. I'll tell you about your other suggestion. I don't think we'll be doing a whole show on foreign films or documentaries or silent films. What we do is we make it as part of the mix. For example, the show that plays tomorrow will have two documentaries on it. Lonesome Creek, which was nominated for an Oscar last year, and Mandela, about Nelson Mandela, is a nominee this year. And we do foreign films. We have Mabarossi coming up on the show that plays a week from Saturday. That's this astounding new Japanese film. But we include them as part of the mix, and we are very assiduous in not only showing commercial hit films. We do show subtitle films, independent films, documentary films, and revivals.
I'd like to... one of my... particular obsessions is not just entropy politically, environmentally, but I see it, entropy, a great deal, or I see what I conclude to be that.
Everything running down?
In Hollywood, in movies like this damn Twister movie, Jurassic Park, nothing but one sheep.
Well, now Jurassic Park was better than Twister.
Well, in a kind of mind, if you like riding roller coasters, and if maybe your dream of heaven is riding roller coasters and merry-go-rounds forever, with heaps and heaps of mullets.
I'm in sympathy with you. On the other hand, as a movie critic, it's my job to say whether a roller coaster is good or bad. I can understand somebody who doesn't want to ride a roller coaster at all, but there are levels of achievement, even in the roller coaster business. Actually, I happen to be a good friend of one of the former presidents of the Coaster Boasters, which is a group that actually rates roller coasters. And in terms of roller coaster movies, I thought Jurassic Park was one of the better ones, even though I might agree with you that it would be better off, you'd be better off maybe going to see a more thoughtful film.
I'll buy that, and I'm going to get off and let you talk to somebody else.
Nice to hear from you from Taylorville again.
Right.
Thanks for the call. I wanted to ask you about the comments of some studio mogul, and I'm sorry that I can't specifically tell you who it was. This was a story that was in the New York Times a few weeks ago, and perhaps you saw it, and it was kind of a reaction to the standard sort of criticism that Hollywood makes junk, and also those people who said that you can see from the movies this time around that were nominated for Academy Awards, virtually nothing sort of coming out of Hollywood. It's just another nail in that coffin that says, you know, Hollywood never makes anything artistic. And the comment of the studio person was something to the effect of, give me a break. You guys, you critic guys, would be on us no matter what we did. And if we tried to make artsy films, you'd let us have it even then.
No, I don't think so. First of all, I don't think that most critics pay any attention to who makes a film. I don't like a film better because it's from Miramax instead of from Paramount. I like it better if it's good instead of bad. And essentially, the major studios are now in a position where their average picture costs $60 to $80 million to make and is intended for a worldwide audience, including an audience that doesn't want to listen to a lot of dialogue because it's going to be dubbed or subtitled for them, so that action becomes international. This is ironic because in the silent days, a film made anywhere could play anywhere. And now I think the big-budget action films are getting more and more silent, in that dialogue becomes less and less important because, once again, they want to have this international market where a film can play anywhere. Well, of course, you can't have character and situation and subtlety without dialogue. And so then you get into the situation where an independent film, which might be budgeted anywhere from $24,000, which is, you know, I've seen films made for that little, to more typically $1, $2, $3, $5, or even $8 or $10 million, these films are simply made in a different way. They have different kinds of overhead, different kinds of executives connected to them, different production budgets, different schedules, and the big studios are too big to make them. It's just like General Motors can't make a car that will only sell 1,000 copies a year. Ford can't make the Rolls-Royce. They can't make 800 cars. They have to make 80,000 cars. It's the way their assembly line works. And I think the studios have more or less said, what we're going to do is we're going to make the big pictures and leave the other kinds of pictures to independents. But, of course, what's ironic is that all the independent distributors, except one, are associated with major studios. Miramax is Disney. Fox Searchlight is Fox. Sony Classics is Sony. Fine Line is Time Warner and Turner. And October is now being shopped around, and somebody's probably going to buy October. So it's like they have a boutique shop inside the big studio, a little studio that's kind of quasi-independent and makes the smaller film.
And then the big studio can sort of, by association with that, they can sort of say, well, yeah, no, we're not just responsible for – we don't just don't Independence Day. Look at this, you know, these fine films that we're involved with.
One colossal irony – is that this year's Oscar is probably going to go to The English Patient. The English Patient was a 20th Century Fox film until 2 weeks before the start date for shooting. And there was an enormous fight between the producer and the director on the one hand and the studio on the other hand over casting. And the studio wanted bigger stars. And Anthony Minghella and Saul Zant said, no, this is the cast and this is the way it is. And Fox pulled its money out. And the cinematographer went back home to Australia, and the stars dispersed. And Saul Zantz, the producer, flew to New York and met with Harvey Weinstein, the head of Miramax, gave him the script and gave him a pitch. Harvey took the script home, and the next morning he called up Saul and he said, you've got the money. Now, to do that, he called Joe Roth, who's the head of production at Disney, because Miramax is a division of Disney. And Roth was able to okay this enormous for Miramax expenditure, probably the biggest movie Miramax has made. So now English Patient is going to win the Oscar, and it'll be a Miramax picture, and everybody will talk about how an independent film won the Oscar, and everybody connected with 20th Century Fox, right on up to its chairman, Rupert Murdoch, is going to be weeping and gnashing their teeth because it could have been a Fox picture. But, of course, Fox felt, oh, we have to have big stars in this. We have to spend more money on it and spend more money advertising it. And nobody's heard of Ralph Fiennes and Juliette Binoche and Kristin Scott Thomas. And so now they're all nominated for Oscars. So people have heard of them now.
Mm. Well, I will give some more folks a chance to talk with you. Going here to Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was a teenager when I first saw 2001, so it's very interesting coming back and seeing it, you know, 30 years later and so forth. But it was interesting because when you started to make your remarks last night about the monolith and what does it mean and so forth, I hadn't a clue as to, you know, I hadn't remembered anything about that. But it was interesting that when the monolith first cropped up, my initial reaction was, oh, that's religion. And I was wondering if the idea of the monolith being religion is one that's sort of trite and hackneyed and cliched. Do you have a response to that?
I think that your interpretation is, first of all, it's your own, but it certainly could be valid. Spirituality, maybe, rather than religion.
Mm-hmm.
I think religion is an organized system created by man's intelligence, and spirituality is what religion seeks.
But see, the reason that I thought it was a structured kind of religion is because I saw it, like, at the beginning with the apes, I thought, okay, on one side, they're a part of that group, and it does something for them as a group, and one of the things it does is that it excludes people on the other side. And then at the end of the movie, I saw, you know, it's still being religion because it was there when the fellow died.
You're thinking of religion as a tribal thing. In other words, if I belong to one religion, you belong to the other, then we have to be separate and enemies.
Well, that's part of it. And then I thought of the monolith sort of turning, and I thought, you know, when religion sort of opens its doors, so to speak, you can see people on the other side, whereas, of course, when you turn it the sort of original way, it does serve to exclude people. So anyway, I just was toying with that idea, and as I say, I hadn't remembered anything about what the speculation was that it sort of symbolized at the time.
Certainly, when the monolith appears, the music on the soundtrack is quasi-liturgical.
I guess maybe that's...
I feel... Okay, see, you have your interpretation, and I can give you mine, and neither one of us can prove
a
thing.
I'm not,
but I feel that, in a way...
That's part of the interesting thing of this
movie. What the movie is telling us is we have to get beyond our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
We are bodies of flesh and blood, and we use tools, physical tools, a bone or a spaceship or a computer. They're all tools.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the movie, when the body decays and grows old and dies, but somehow is transformed through the presence of the monolith into the Star Child,
mm-hmm.
which turns and looks out to the audience. And that Star Child is not supposed to be physical, I don't think. It's not located in any physical place.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if the movie is saying, we have gone as far as tools can take us.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's time to liberate ourselves from flesh and to continue our journey as intelligence.
Sure. Well,
in his new book, 3001, Arthur Clarke talks about a computer that he calls the Soul Catcher. He believes that it would be possible to download your memories, your personality, your intelligence, your knowledge, you, into a computer. And then you would be on a chip. Now, you might think that would be very odd, but think how odd it is that you're in your head.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everything that we are is in this brain that's inside our skull. That's where we are.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be any stranger to be on a chip or to have a chip in our head, in a way, as long as we still thought of ourselves in the same way.
Well, that's sort of like the Natalie Wood movie, as I recall, what was a Brainstorm or something like that.
Yeah, that's the one.
You could record the whole business. But it was interesting last night because I brought my 10-year-old and 12-year-old children, and they sort of looked at each other and said, what the hell was all that about? And I sort of said, well, everything.
But they will remember, and they will see it in 20 years, and they will now, at that point, have more complex ideas.
Absolutely, and that's the reason that they went late to school today, and that's the reason that they were up until midnight.
Well, they will talk about it, and it will sink in.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't it be an interesting idea? And I think that now with MRI imaging and so forth, we can actually see the brain while it's thinking. So we're learning more about the brain than we knew before. And this is one of the topics that's being discussed this week during Cyberfest.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be interesting if at some point in the future, the entire contents of your brain could be downloaded into a chip? Now, let's say it's more or less the end of your days. And instead of being frozen, like they're doing now with the cryogenics,
mm-hmm.
You're downloaded into a chip. And that chip is put into a little spaceship and sent off somewhere, like the Voyager, which has now left the solar system with the Beatles songs and Beethoven and Shakespeare on board. And because the chip is shut down, you don't get any older. You don't, 20 million years may pass, but it won't seem long to you because the chip will be in the sleep mode.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, the chip could be awakened. You would be in a spaceship that would give you eyes and ears and, the ability to express yourself. And that would be maybe the way that mankind will be able to colonize the stars or explore the stars. Because our bodies aren't going to make it there.
Right.
Unless somebody develops a hyperdrive through a wormhole in space and time, we as a species are never going to make it to another solar system. They're too far away.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't that be neat if everybody, wouldn't that be kind of spiritual or beautiful in a way? Everybody on Earth, when you die, instead of just dying, or maybe even at a little earlier point, before you're really decrepit, download yourself at that point onto a chip. Then put the chip on sleep mode. You continue to live until you get old and die. When you die, they put the chip on a spaceship and fire it off into space. So that every year, several hundred million people set off on their destinations with the thought that long, long after this planet is a cinder, one of those chips somewhere may open its eyes on a new sunset somewhere.
But I guess in a way, it's one of the things that we all have to remember is that time and time on Earth is valuable because it is finite. And I guess in a way, I sort of wonder whether or not people would just say, okay, well, everything is infinite now, so I don't have to do this and I don't have to do that, and I will have a million chances or a billion chances to live out my life.
Well, that's a very good question. That's a very good response. Let me put it to you this way. One of the problems with growing old is eventually we grow real old.
Yes.
And we lose our memory, and we lose our health, and we lose our zest, and we lose our strength. And that's why there's a limit.
Sure.
Wouldn't it be great if your mind, I mean, I've talked to so many old people who say, inside this ancient body is a teenager.
Right.
It's the same person in here that was always in here. I just look older to you.
Right.
I know that I'd like to live for a good long time.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to find out what's going to happen 100 years from now. I love the statement that Louis Buñuel, the movie director, makes in his autobiography. He says the thing that annoys him most about dying is that he won't be able to read tomorrow morning's newspaper. And when they buried him with a copy of the next day's paper. I'd always like to read tomorrow's paper.
Yes, I would too. I would too. Thank you for thank you for coming, and thank you for your interesting comments and work.
Sure. Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
We'll try and get at least one more person here. We'll go to line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Mr. Ebert, I would like to say, and again, we in this community appreciate your support, especially when you helped the art theater a little while back.
They're all set now, I guess, they've got a target date for the next stage of their renovation over there, and they've got their new seats online, I guess.
Yeah, I thought that was really good, man. But I just have a quick comment, because I know the time is short. I am, as a science fiction fan, I love the movie 2001, and it's a really great movie. But on the converse side of that, there's a lot of science fiction movies made like Dune, where if you read the Dune book, and you saw the movie, it was just so bad. It just seems like it's really difficult to make really good science fiction. And
yeah.
I don't know. I just like to have a general commentary on that because I thought that for a long time and been very disappointed by that.
Well, you can't make a good movie by committee. And you can't make a low-budget science fiction movie very easily because it takes so many special effects. And the bigger a budget is, the more people get their hands in the pie. And that may just be a built-in problem with science fiction movies. They're special effects films. They cost a lot of money. You got all the producers and studio executives saying, well, this isn't clear. This is too ambiguous. You need a bigger star here. You got to have some action at some point. And the whole original idea gets lost. What we can hope for is special effects are getting cheaper because computers are getting more powerful. I was amazed to hear I heard William Gibson speak recently, the author of the man who created the word cyberspace, or he popularized
it. Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
And he talks about Kubrick, at every teenager, a Kubrick in his own basement. You know, some kid down in the basement with a computer someday is going to be able to make a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Today, a kid in the basement can make a movie. It may not be ready to be played in a movie theater yet. But someday, and the day is going to happen in our lifetime, you will be able to buy a computer, take it home, take it out of the box, set it up, and make a movie on it if you want to. You know, and at that time, maybe science fiction will get better because it will be liberated from the committee meddling that takes place on big-budget special effects pictures.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, with the I just think they have too much special effects, and they oversimplify stories that are retold again and again. And
oh, yeah, look at that. What was that Keanu Reeves movie based on a William Gibson
I can't remember.
One of his novels. Because
Johnny Mnemonic?
Yeah, Johnny Mnemonic.
Yeah, where the guy had the chip in his head.
That's the one. Yeah. I think Gibson is a very interesting writer.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about his newest book, Adoru, which is the one about the Japanese, about the rock star who falls in love with the Japanese cyber girl, the woman who exists only in terms of computer memory, is that he creates in his book an idea of cyberspace, which is really more convincing than virtual reality really is today. In other words, if you want to experience virtual reality, it's more fun to read about it than to do it.
I'm really sorry to have to jump in. My apologies to callers, but we're out of time.
We could keep talking. You have some. Your listeners are so smart.
Yes, they are.
Not one person asked me who was going to win the Academy Award. I am so impressed.
If in future you're ever in the neighborhood, you're welcome to come by.
I love this neighborhood.
We appreciate it.
Okay.
Very much. Roger Ebert.
Take care.